The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Seeking Witchcraft. I'm your host, Ashley. And today I have on guest Nicholas Pearson, author of Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense, 145 Gemstones for Banishing, Binding, and Magical Protection. Welcome to the show, Nicholas. Thank you so much for coming on today. Could you introduce yourself to the listeners?
I'd be delighted. First and foremost, thank you for having me. If anyone wants to kind of peer inside my head, I love rocks. I'm also a bit of a nerd. So when you combine those two things together, I love to explore, you know, the energy, the metaphysics, the magic associated with crystals and minerals and gemstones throughout history. But I also enjoy the science. I currently work in the earth science field in collections management for a very large but rather disorganized mineral collection here in the southeastern U.S. Of great historic value. I love solving mysteries, and that's part of what the earth science part of this does. It helps me look for trends. You know, do iron minerals carry a particular kind of vibe, or does something that's formed in this process versus that process open up kind of new pathways to energy? So, you know, for a long time, I've kind of just organically seeing these patterns between the mystical and the mineralogical. But at some point in my life, I decided I was going to follow that thread a little bit more intensively and made a really thorough study of crystal energy as it overlaps between the historical, the occult, the folkloric, as well as the kind of modern trends that we see in crystal healing and, you know, gemstone energy medicine, and then comparing that with what I knew and could observe in the geological sphere.
I think that's incredible that you were able to make a career out of something related to your special interests. I wish that I could say the same. Unfortunately, my career is not built like that. But I think that's so incredible, having an opportunity to work in this realm. So when did you very, very first pick up a crystal? Were you a kid, a teenager? Were you more of an adult? Like what made you say, I really want to look more into this?
You know, it started when I think like a lot of people like us, as a little kid, I picked up rocks everywhere. There was just something so magical about finding a perfectly round pebble, or one that had a freshly cleaved face, or one that, you know, showed the kind of little angular interlocking grains of the minerals inside. Just everyone that spoke to me came home with me. Also early in my childhood, I took a special fondness for my grandmother's collection of vintage turquoise jewelry. I loved how no two examples of turquoise were the same. You had different patterns and veins and other kind of characteristics, even though they were all the same mineral species. And I'm guessing my grandfather observed these two phenomena over and over and over again. And he gave me my very first piece of quartz, which was my first proper mineral specimen, a little over 30 years ago. And I tell you, that object was like something straight out of a myth or a fairy tale. And I was just so enamored. I still have that piece of quartz in my collection today. It's still in a special place in my home. But, you know, that gift inadvertently launched a lifelong quest to learn more about crystals.
Oh, that's such a lovely story. And you absolutely unlocked a childhood memory for me that I completely forgot about. When I was growing up, there was this complex they were building across the street from us, and the neighborhood kids and I, we went over there because they had kicked up a ton of dirt and rocks as they were doing construction. And I remember that I completely forgot about this until now. I had this big cup filled with all different sorts of rocks, which we all did that back then. And looking back now, there's probably a big chance that some of those were quartz. Some of those were probably also just pieces of concrete that look like a rock, but as a kid, I didn't know the difference. But yeah, I think almost anybody listening might have a similar story of like finding a cool rock, or like if you go to the beach and trying to find like a hagstone, for example, which is a stone that has a circle or like a hole in the middle of it. Yeah, I think that's fascinating. So I want to talk a little bit about the book. So what inspired you to write Crystals for Psychic Self-Defense? Was it an experience that you had, or was it just something that you felt you wanted to get out there with your expertise, or what was kind of the thought process behind it?
A little of column A, a little of column B. Throughout my whole life, I've been, for all meanings of this expression, I've been a really sensitive person, sensitive energetically, sensitive psychically, maybe a little hypervigilant in social situations because of my own baggage, my own trauma, my own upbringing. And the need for a little extra energetic protection has always been there. And sometimes in my life, for some phases or periods, I've been more adept at this, more proactive about it. And at other times, you know, you let those boundaries lapse, energetic or social or otherwise, and things happen. So I have, over these decades, kind of cobbled together a bunch of different practices, some related to crystals and some not, that have been really good for my spiritual hygiene, for my ability to be grounded and centered and more present in the world. And let's face it, even for those of us who don't consider ourselves particularly sensitive to the world around us, whether we're empaths or psychics or healers or witchy folks, you don't really have to be to notice that the world is sometimes not so easy to be in. So observing how common the need, the request is for crystals or other tools to protect us, you know, to keep out the vibes of that other person in our office who, you know, shares a cubicle with us, or to feel safe when we travel by plane or train or car, or to just feel more at home in our environment. This is such a common human need. This is like one of the most universal desires that humans have had, probably since before anatomically modern humans. I mean, we see evidence of hominids that predate us, you know, 500,000 years ago, collecting what could be considered unusual rocks and minerals, presumably for their protective or their spiritual influence. We can't, of course, reconstruct exactly how they were used, but this is such an endemic phenomenon to being embodied here on Earth that I thought this particular topic in the realm of crystals would be something that was super useful to others, but selfishly also something I really needed throughout my life.
I think that's an awesome explanation. Could you talk a little bit about what the listeners can find in your book?
Absolutely. So I tried to write it so it meets a lot of different needs for a lot of different people. So there are going to be some really foundational exercises, advice for choosing crystals and storing them and cleansing them and charging them and, you know, all of that fun stuff. But you're also going to find some techniques that are maybe a little bit more advanced, designing or incorporating rituals along with your crystal practice. Things like spells for banishing and protection, crystal grids, which are something that we form when we combine crystals in a kind of geometric or symbolic pattern to achieve a particular outcome. There are going to be meditations and psychic shields and tools for cleansing yourself and your space. There's a little bit of something for everything you can imagine as it relates to the theme of protection or psychic self-defense.
So one of the things that there's a couple things I really like about your book. One of them is that it's in color, which I think is great. And not only is it in color, but there is a directory of protective crystals that have pictures of what the actual crystals are next to each description. And I think this makes it really easy to understand and reference what somebody may already have or what they might want to purchase. I know when I was first coming into the witchcraft world, I went out to a local crystal shop and I bought a ton of crystals, and I cannot tell you what half of those crystals are that I purchased. But being able to have this directory with actual images of what a crystal might look like is extremely helpful to people like me who might over the years have forgotten what I actually have, or even those who may like find a crystal or get gifted a crystal. It's nice to kind of have a good reference. And I also really love that you have photos scattered throughout your book. Like, you have a picture of like what an amulet looks like, a layout of how to use the stones. There's even a picture of, I'm assuming it's you, with rings on your hand to kind of show just like some of the different crystals. And I think that's really great. I love when books like this are practical, and I'm definitely a visual person, so I like being able to have these different examples to reference throughout the book.
Thank you so much for that. The pictures are really important. My husband is actually my photographer, so it's something that we get to do collaboratively. He did all of the graphic design for the diagrams in this. So, we've had to learn to speak each other's language. We've gotten to a point where now I can like make mock-ups in Canva, really low-tech versions, so he can actually make the nice version that appears in the book. And it's something that I think is so valuable to learners of all varieties. Like you said, some of us are more visual learners, but also with something like crystals, I mean, there's so much that is communicated by their beauty, by their appearance, by the symbolism inherent in their material bodies. And just describing it in words always falls short. So I endeavored to have a variety of things photographed in that directory. You'll notice that there are some really kind of classic examples, you know, the rose quartz, the smoky quartz, the malachite. None of those have really surprising pictures involved, but every now and then I'll have, you know, a couple examples of the same thing, so you can see what it might look like from two different deposits or in two different colors or patterns or textures or shapes, just to remind us that minerals are not exactly a monolith. You know, quartz from two holes in the earth does not look the same. And I wanted to kind of showcase that. Plus, it makes it exciting. I get to show off weird rocks that I've met over the years and share their stories.
I was going to ask, are these crystals from your personal collection?
The vast majority are. I borrowed a handful that were maybe more photogenic than the ones in my own collection, but by and large, most of the things in this book, I think all came from my own stash.
That's awesome. I feel like you probably have such an incredible stash to look at if you were to pile them all together.
I mean, 30 plus years of collecting will do that.
There you go. So I guess we should start with this question. Let me take a step back. So for people who are just beginning in this world of magic and self-defense and psychic self-defense, why is psychic self-defense an important skill to develop? Are people always being attacked, or is it kind of just like a safety shield against themselves all the time?
You know, there's a few layers to this. And I want to preface this by saying whether or not we really are cursed or attacked or under some kind of, you know, psychic duress, the remedy is often the same. Whether you actually are or only believe it, if you go through the same motions, you usually achieve a similar peaceful resolution. So it's good to know that you can use the techniques no matter what. Secondly, actual psychic attack, actual like cursing, hexing, you name it, is pretty rare comparative to everything else. That being said, we are all subjected to different sources of psychic harm. And the number one contributor of that is internal. It's that inner saboteur, that inner critic, that narrative that plays in our head at all times. That is a great source of disharmony, of entropy. And when we learn the fundamentals of magic, we theoretically, if we're doing it well enough, we become more sensitive. We shine a little bit more brightly. We learn to channel energies through us that are new and exciting, that heighten our awareness and perception. So naturally, as we open those doorways to perception, we're going to start noticing more stuff, not just the same stuff, but different things. Likewise, different things start to notice us. And the idea of protection magic or psychic self-defense is not just keeping out things that are seeking us out for the sole intent of causing harm, but more for having effective energetic boundaries in place so we get a little bit of agency in what our experience is like navigating the world as sensitive people, as magical people, as just people. Because at the end of the day, we're all occasionally, maybe more often than that, going to find situations that don't feel good energetically or emotionally or socially. And having a good spiritual hygiene practice, having a good shielding practice, having other psychic self-defense tools in your toolbox is going to help you when you need it most.
I love this sentence that, or the statement that you gave about things start to notice us kind of when you, you know, open that box. And I think that this definitely plays in well with witchcraft. And with my students, I'll tell them that part of the reason that we will cast a circle is because once you start engaging in some magical practice, things kind of start getting attracted to that. And the circle is to help protect us. And so I'm definitely seeing a little bit of a overlap here with crystals. That's kind of like having a, I don't want to say a physical circle on you at all times, but kind of, depending on the type of crystal that you have, if I have that correct in my mind.
Absolutely. You know, think of it as portable armor. You can take it with you. You can create sacred space on the go in the kind of microcosm. We can also use them around our physical ritual space. If you're creating a space in the material to work your magic, to do your healing, your meditation, whatever it might be, you can mark the perimeter of that with a handful of stones. It can be as simple as, you know, one at each of the, you know, four cardinal points on the compass. It could also be maybe more elaborate depending on what works for you. Similarly, you can kind of map that out to your living quarters, whether it's a whole home or just a room or whatever we have available to us. And then everything that takes place within that is moderated by, is protected or reinforced by the energy that the crystals bring.
And let's also not forget that if you're going out into the physical world, if it ever came down to it, you could have physical protection if you have a big rock in your pocket.
Yep, absolutely. You know, a rock and a sock could be swung with great force if you needed it.
Exactly. I mean, they're a little expensive to be doing that, but you know, if duty calls, you got some physical protection too.
Yeah. If it's me or the rose quartz is going so I can stay.
Exactly. All right. Well, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back. Oh, sorry. We're going to take a short break and we'll be back in just a moment. All right. Welcome back. So I want to shift a little bit of the conversation about, like, you know, if somebody's completely new to crystals, how do they work? What are some stones you recommend? So, and I definitely want to talk about like the ethics of crystals too. So do you have a place that you would like to start?
Yeah, well, let's start like as beginners, what do we mean when we say crystal energy? So I like to wear my science hat to give us models for how the energies we can't measure might work. Energy is the capacity to do work. That's a really vague definition, but that's what we use in the science world. So that's what we'll use here. So energy is something that typically we can measure, we can quantify, we can transfer it from one state or system to another. So, you know, crystal energy has to be informed by what a crystal is. And crystals are, generally speaking, solid substances that have regular compositions. In other words, it's always the same ingredients and a repeating symmetrical structure. So those same ingredients come together in predictable kind of rhythmic way that is very orderly. So that orderly makeup of a crystal generates a very orderly energy field. And the thing about that is we are anything but orderly in more ways than one. But, you know, our energy bodies, just from what we can measure, just the electromagnetic side of it, is constantly in flux, is always changing, is adapting to new things at all times, and is sometimes really chaotic and out of sync with itself. If we introduce something that is so perfectly organized to that, it becomes kind of a template, like a tuning fork that we can use to subconsciously adjust our own energy field and come into harmony with that outside influence, in this case, the crystal. We can also, through a kind of witchier lens, think about the archetype, the essence, the spirit of a stone and its indwelling intelligence, and regard them as collaborators in our magical and spiritual practice. They're not just inert tools. They're not just a means to an end, but they also are these partners and spiritual allies that we can learn to work with. And when we also think about it through that framework, I think it opens the door to a discussion about the ethics of crystal consumption really well. And because if they're not just inert tools, but if they are in fact beings, maybe not living in a biological sense, but if they are have some sparkle of life within them, that predisposes us maybe to wanting to treat them with the respect and dignity that all beings deserve. And that's why we're seeing an increase in, say, the quality and quantity of conversations being had about the ethics of consumption. And unfortunately, there's no satisfying soundbite here. Like, in a sentence or two, I can't give someone a really clear piece of advice that says, do this if you want to consume crystals ethically. It's so much more nuanced, because mining and extraction is such a big industry. And the healing crystal part of that market, while big, is very, very tiny in comparison to everything else. We're not just talking, you know, jewelry and gemstones and art. We're thinking architecture, communications technology, transportation, infrastructure. All of these things are interfacing with the earth in terms of mining and extracting mineral resources. So I don't say that to give us a kind of get out of jail free card. It's not like, oh, well, it doesn't matter because it's such a small sector of the market. And in fact, I think that means it's easier to make some kind of shift in it. But we have to remember that we can't just scapegoat crystals as being the problem child when it's also cosmetics. It's also in our phones. It's also in our cars. It's in all parts of life. So when we want to be a more mindful shopper, the number one thing we can do is start contemplating provenance. And what this means is we want to know something about where a crystal comes from and how it got from there to here. So in like the rockhound and mineralogical world, provenance is really important. It helps determine, you know, the relative rarity and value of things. It tells us something about the geological history involved, but it can also give us clues about what practices might have been used in the production of it. So, you know, there are some places on Earth that have some pretty egregious human rights violations with their mining practices. These are things that are really easily Googleable. There are also places on Earth where what they do to the environment through mining and extraction is also pretty darn deplorable. But we have to hold space for the fact that we can't categorically throw everything out. So for example, there are some pretty horrific things happening in the Democratic Republic of the Congo right now. And you might go, well, I'm never going to buy another Congolese mineral ever. But if you use technology, you're using Congolese minerals. And it is in fact the technology that is driving those really awful practices. Whether or not you buy a piece of chrysocolla or malachite or cobaltoin calcite from the Congo is not going to change what is actually driving that. And in fact, sometimes, paradoxically, it is the sale of those accessory minerals, those things that are actually the cast off of the industrial mining practices, that give our indigenous peoples, our indigenous miners, the laborers actually doing the work, a chance to create a new revenue stream, maybe one that they control and can set the prices on. So asking questions about where things come from, inquiring about maybe the length of the supply chain. You know, a lot of retailers don't want to tell you exactly what business they bought their stuff from, because you could just eliminate them from you know, the supply chain altogether. But we can start asking questions, not are your crystals ethical, but, you know, I'm really interested in supporting independent miners and, you know, fair trade kinds of things. Do you have anything that satisfies that? And some retailers genuinely don't know, because they just go to a big wholesale show, they buy what they need, and that's it. But if we start having those conversations on a local level, it signals to those shop owners that this is important. And so they will continue to have those questions with their suppliers and so on and so forth. And you are seeing a lot of folks who are going out of their way to get things where they can kind of map out what the ethical impact is on one level or another. But we just have to be mindful that, you know, under a system that profits from extraction, there is no 100% guilt-free, totally ethical form of consumption. So I always like to think of it in terms of harm reduction. Can I buy directly from a miner, or with as few links in the chain between me and the person who dug it from the earth to ensure they're getting paid fairly? Can I go someplace and pick up something myself? Can I use things that are in my native landscape? I'm here in Florida. We've got lots of limestone and fossils and lots of great stuff with great energies. So there are a lot of creative ways that we can kind of circumvent some of the ethical ramifications. And at the end of the day, the crystals you've already got, the crystals already on shelves, they've already gotten here. We don't have to feel guilty about them being here. Like, embrace what you love, and we'll just start asking questions going forward.
Thank you so much for explaining that. I think, as you said, it's really important to ask questions, see where things come from. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you are doing your best and you're doing as many right things as you possibly can to make sure your things are ethically sourced, I think you're on the right track to doing the best you can. It could be hard. This actually made me think of another question. I know that some people I've heard online have had issues purchasing crystals that they thought was a crystal, but it actually ended up being glass, or I don't know, might have been marketed as something else. Do you have a way that people could, I don't know, check to make sure they're actually getting something that's legitimate?
You know, this is kind of complicated too, because
the
telltale signs of inauthentic malachite are very different to the telltale signs of inauthentic citrine. So, like, my most practical advice that I can give anyone who's concerned about this, other than just find a reputable source and stick with them, ask questions, and buy from people who give you honest answers, the best thing I can do is intentionally seek out the fake stuff. Like, go to your local gem and mineral show, look online, find articles about it. In person is the best, because then you can, you know, put the real thing and the not so real thing side by side. You know, the heft of natural malachite is so much greater than the resins that we see being passed off as the real thing. Poured resin and poured glass looks so different to natural quartz, even when it's polished. So being able to put them side by side is a really useful technique. There are, you know, specific mineralogical and gemological tests that we can perform, but the one we perform for amethyst looks very different to the one that we perform for opal. So instead of trying to give you a 12-hour presentation on that, go look for the wrong thing and absorb everything you can about it, how it feels in your hand, how light bounces off or moves through it, the exact range of colors it comes in, what the surface textures are like, the weight of it. Gather all of that and just kind of keep it in the back of your mind, because once you've seen enough of it, you're going to be able to recognize it instantly.
I love the suggestion to go to a gem and mineral show. I hadn't even thought about that. And I see ads for that probably once or twice a year, just through the radio or through billboards on the side of the road. I think that's a fantastic idea. Thanks for bringing that up. I was going to ask, I do see a lot of people when they talk about crystals, the next question that comes with it is about cleansing and charging and if it's still effective and throwing their crystals in the moonlight or the sunlight, which I know for some crystals like amethyst can bleach them out. From personal experience, I've had that happen to me. Do you have anything you can speak on this? Is how important is cleansing and charging your crystals, or can they come pre-charged, or what can a beginner do to ensure that their crystals are good to go?
Yeah, this is such a great topic. So, you know, first and foremost, let's break down what we mean when we say cleansing and charging. Currently on the internet, when you see a lot of actions referred to under that umbrella of charging, they're fundamentally things that clear or refresh a crystal's energy. So cleansing, I think, is really important. We wash our hands when they're dirty. We change our sheets when they're dirty. We change our clothes and put them in the laundry when they're dirty. So our psychic hygiene is just as important as our physical hygiene. And sometimes, depending on how sensitive we are, maybe it's more important. So cleansing your crystals on a regular basis, and regular doesn't necessarily mean frequent. It can, but you know, once a week is regular, once a month is regular, once every time you use it is regular. So you get to kind of feel out what is the rhythm behind that that works for you. But cleansing allows a crystal to reset itself. Crystals are naturally good at retaining a tiny imprint of all the energies they experience. It's as if they record or store all of those memories. And they don't differentiate between good and bad. So cleansing isn't something we do because crystals have bad energy in them. It's just so we can kind of wring out the sponge so it's ready to absorb new stuff. Now, charging, on the other hand, originally, when we see the word charge being applied to spiritual practices, not just crystals, but herbs and, you know, wands and athames and other ritual tools, charging isn't putting an external energy into a crystal or another tool. Charging comes from an older meaning of the word, which we don't use as often in English. And it's the idea of being rendered with a task. You have a job to carry out. I charge you with the responsibility of blank. So charging was about imbuing your intention, your goals, your magical desires into your tools. This can be a once and done thing. Like you have one crystal that is like a sentinel for your living room, and it is charged with only one responsibility. But also like the tumbled stones that you use to build grids or carry in your pocket or use in rituals, you might cleanse them and charge them, dedicate them to new tasks all the time. So instead of thinking of charging as, you know, putting something under the moonlight, let that be a cleansing task because that's really what it's doing. The shift in the language here is tied to shift in our experience with technology because we have portable devices that have batteries that get worn down in the span of hours. Sometimes we have to plug them in to charge them. Crystals don't get depleted energetically through use, not typically at least. So charging isn't about putting energy in because they've run out of steam. Charging is about collaborating with your crystals to achieve a particular outcome. Because crystals are so good at remembering or retaining energies, we can charge them with an outside influence. Like you could put your favorite moonstone under the moon to bless and cleanse it of the stuff that it's picked up. You could also specifically draw down that lunar energy and like charge your moonstone up with it to carry that forward, because specifically what you want to do is work with lunar energy. But if we're not specifically imbuing it with that intention, it's just cleansing. So I think cleansing is, you know, pretty darn regular and something I'm sure none of us do as often as we need to, myself included. I have too many rocks and too little time and way too many projects. And charging is secondary to that. Like when I want to achieve a particular goal, then I might move into that charging phase with a particular stone and then cleanse it when we're ready to move on to something new.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that or acknowledging that this is something people might not do all the time, even if they quote unquote need to. You know, life gets busy. And sometimes I know a lot of people struggle with wanting to have a perfect practice, which can be paralyzing just even hearing the term. So I think it's nice to acknowledge that, like, you know, life happens. If we don't charge something all the time, it's okay. You know, so thank you for mentioning all of that about charging and the differences between charging and cleansing. And yeah, I think that's great information, especially for beginners who are just trying to get into this space to learn more about crystals overall. Now, let me ask you before we wrap up the episode, do you have a favorite crystal?
Oh gosh, it's kind of like asking a parent their favorite child. If the answer is yes, they feel kind of silly saying it out loud, but I have a handful of favorites that I kind of like work through on a regular and continual basis. Like right now, especially tied to the themes of this book and kind of where I'm at in life, I'm going through a big renaissance of labradorite. Labradorite is such a wonderful stone for witchy folk of all kinds for a lot of reasons. There's something kind of brightening and clarifying about its energy. Whenever you get a chance to look at a nice piece and turn it in the light, you'll see it goes from kind of a dull gray or brown color to having this like spectral iridescence that emerges from within when the light hits it just right. And this is created by its really unique structure. So this mineral has these twin layers, these bands that it's made out of called laminae, like the word to laminate. And as light passes through, depending on the thickness of the layer, it can scatter out a certain wavelength of light. So you might see blue or gold or green or red. And energetically, it has the same kind of property. So whenever we feel like our boundaries are running a little thin or starting to feel a little sensitive to the world around us, rather than shutting ourselves off entirely with this impenetrable barrier, labradorite is like a selectively permeable membrane. It scatters some of the things we don't want, it reflects them out. It allows lots of other things to come and go with ease, so it's breathable. And at the same time, because it takes ordinary light and makes it look so extraordinary, it cranks up the brilliance on our own energy, our own magic. It really helps us shine and find our place. So a lot of folks work with it, not just for protection, but for imagining and creating a better tomorrow, for boosting their manifestation, for improving the efficacy of their magic. It's such a well-rounded stone. It's truly enchanting in all meanings of that word.
It is a beautiful stone. I will say that my favorite stone is my birthstone, which is amethyst. And I really appreciate that you had not only just regular amethyst in the book, but you also have chevron amethyst in here, which I never thought to consider as two separate stones. Not saying they're necessarily separate, they're both amethyst, but you have two separate blurbs for them, which was very interesting for me to read. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, I love seeing how the same variety of a gemstone, the same species of a mineral, can show up in a lot of different permutations in the natural world. So, you know, nature doesn't fit into perfect boxes all of the time, but we as human beings love labels. We love to categorize stuff. So, you know, we've got the quartz umbrella, we've got the amethyst umbrella under that, and then we've got, you know, smoky amethyst and chevron amethyst and amethyst with cacoxenite and, you know, so many other wonderful varieties. So I tried to spotlight a few special varieties of stones throughout the book like that, whether it's different quartzes or different agates or different jaspers, even a couple different varieties of granite and marble in addition to their, you know, kind of standard variants.
I love that you brought up granite and marble, because sometimes people forget that their kitchen or their bathroom may very well have a gigantic crystal in it at all times.
Yeah. And these are the kind of rocks that our ancestors, our antecedents in the witchy world have used. It's not always the rare and the valuable gemstones like emeralds and rubies and sapphires. It's the humble chalk and slate, the bit of limestone or granite that they've had access to. And those are such powerful, energetic tools and allies in our craft. So when we get to know them, they can really make some incredible magic in our lives.
Absolutely. Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for coming on. Where could the listeners find your books and find you as well?
Yeah, thank you. So you can find the books, hopefully, anywhere books are sold. Definitely go hit up your local independent bookstore or crystal shop or a cult bookstore. Even if they don't have one of my books, they'd be happy to order them for you, I'm sure. And if you want to learn more about me and my work, the best place to find it all is theluminouspearl.com. It's got my calendar of events. You can sign up for my newsletter, check out all my other books. This is my ninth one so far, with more on the way very soon.
Fantastic. Do you have any social media information, or is it all on your website?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So, and if you want to find me on social media, thank you for asking. I'm at The Luminous Pearl in most places, Facebook, Instagram, and so on and so forth.
Fantastic. And if you want to find me, you can find me on Facebook at Seeking Witchcraft Podcast, on Instagram at Seeking Witchcraft, or if you want to support the show, you could do so on patreon.com/seekingwitchcraft. Nicholas, one last question before we depart. If you could give one piece of advice to a beginner, somebody who is completely new and does not have to be related to anything we discussed today, what would you say to that person?
Oh, I've got a good one that is loosely related to this topic of psychic self-defense.
Sure.
You know, as beginners, when we do start to become more sensitive to energies, and also when energies and entities start to become more sensitive to us, it's so easy to get overwhelmed. Even if you don't buy the book and use all the exercises, even if you don't have a, you know, massive apothecary of crystals and herbs and other things, there is a really simple practice that we can do that can help us with that overwhelm. And it's very simply to just mind our own business. Energetically, all of that stuff happening in the periphery can be exciting, but it can also be distracting. So get grounded and get centered and focus on what matters. The rest of that stuff has been there all along in most cases energetically. So there's no need to let it start overwhelming us now as we become more sensitive.
I think that is fantastic advice, not just in the spiritual realm, but just in real life too.
Very that, yes.
Oh my gosh. That is fantastic advice. Thank you so much. And again, thank you so much for coming on. It was such a pleasure talking to you and learning more about crystals. When Nicholas and I were first talking before we record this episode, I was telling him I personally don't know a lot about crystals. So a lot of this was very informative to me as well. So thank you so much for all of that. And it was such a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and talk to you later. Bye.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.